switch into the, while we want to go forward from this particular background, we would like to focus on two examples of what actually UNESCO did in terms of science for peace. Because one thing was a concept and ideology which was formed early on by big thinkers and visionaries that gave the concept of UNESCO. Something else was how to implement it. And there are two examples which we would like to concentrate on in the second part of this session. Now, the second part first will be a short introduction. So, CERN. CERN was a product of UNESCO. It was formed under UNESCO auspices. Of course, initiative came from famous physicists of that time after the Second World War. But in order to construct the concept and the institution, an organization was needed that was mothered this concept, and it was UNESCO. At the beginning, CERN had just 12 European member states. Now it's already 21, with about 2,300 staff and a lot of staff that is collaborating with UNESCO, with CERN from all over the year. And the whole project becomes... why I don't see on the screen what I am... Okay. This now is really a global endeavor. So distribution of all CERN users by September 2015, as you see, covers more or less all continents and every country. When you see numbers, of course numbers are small, but this is really a global enterprise nowadays. Now, Science for Peace, when CERN was constructed, was based on two basic ideas. One, to enable construction of a facility beyond means of individual member state, because to construct such a big center to study experimental physics was too expensive. And second, to foster cooperation between peoples recently in conflict. And after the Second World War, CERN was actually the first organization of European caliber in which Germany was officially admitted as member after the Second World War, and other members of the coalition, Italy, Spain, and so on. SESAMI was conceived with the same two aims. So members of SESAMI are Bahrain, Cyprus, Egypt, Iran, Israel, Jordan, Pakistan, Palestinian Authority, and Turkey. And there is a lot of observers who help SESAMI to survive. SESAMI will become operational in 2016. Here you have a building. And what is actually a difference between CERN and SESAMI, that CERN was composed after the war to heal wounds, whereas SESAMI still has members that are in active conflict very often with each other, which is unheard of. And this is actually the only operational platform of scientific collaboration formally established between Israel and Iran. So this is something that is absolutely exceptional in our view. Here you have members and their geographical distribution. SESAMI is real. This is an experimental hall, a picture of experimental hall and a booster. It really stands there. You should go to Jordan and see it yourself. Then when you have an element of storage ring, which are now constructed, storage ring where you accelerate, when you accelerate electrons, you see that actually countries that participate in production of this storage ring is everybody. Pakistan, Cyprus, Spain, Italy, Switzerland, Israel, and so on and so forth. So this is already an international endeavor by itself. There will be already under construction, some of them almost functional, experimental setups that allow you to make experiments throughout natural sciences, chemistry, biology, crystallography of various types, archaeology, material science, very broad application. And most important, SESAME is already quite active in its training program, and there is really a large group of youngsters in the Middle East and surrounding countries that participate in training activities, and you see these young faces there. So I wanted you to make sure to have this short introduction so that everybody understands why we are here and why we decided about these two examples, CERN and SESAME. Now, the rest of the meeting will be a discussion of the panel composed of four panelists, two former directors of CERN, Zera Sayers, who is scientific chair of the scientific committee of SESAME, and Dr. Turek Jan, who is not only former AAAS, but nowadays a very important figure in the science policy of United States, because recently he was nominated a science advisor to John Kerry, to the Secretary of State. So with these four participants, we will try to understand, asking some questions on how actually this science for peace works, what is working, what is not working, what can be improved. But before that, I would like to have from each of you 2 minutes about yourself. How it happened that you actually are scientist, famous, working for peace? What actually was the trigger? Herwig Schopper is the first, please.
I think only 30 seconds would be enough. Look, I'm a special character because my family has Austrian origin. I am born in Czechoslovakia. I became German after the war. I don't know.
Yeah.
I became German after the war, and I'm living since 30 years in Switzerland. So I am European. But during all my life, from the very first youth, I learned already how important it is for people from different nations, mentalities, religions, to work peacefully together. So after having learned that, I was really fascinated, but later I realized that science is an excellent tool to promote these objectives. So whenever I had the chance in science to do that, I did it. Thank you.
Well, thanks. Sir Chris Wellensmith.
Thanks. So I did a PhD in theoretical physics, and the head of the group was Rudolf Piles, who was one of the founders of the Pugwash Group, in fact, which was a group of scientists trying to harness science for peace. But he was an extremely eminent scientist who had a stream of visitors from around the world. And I found that extremely enriching personally, that I was working as a student with visitors from everywhere. Then I had, before I took more permanent positions, 3 positions as a postdoc. The first was in Moscow for 7 months, then a couple of years in Geneva, and a couple of years in Stanford. And that I also find personally, you really came to appreciate the different points of view that people had. I'd like to say something that I haven't heard so much. I think actually it was scientifically beneficial because the Russian school of theoretical physics, for example, approached problems very differently in those days. And by learning in these different schools, I think you brought new approaches. And I think actually at CERN, when you put together an engineer trained in France, in Germany, the UK, Russia, they look differently at problems. And then they'd say to each other, we're all wrong, here's a new solution. And I'm a little bit worried with the globalization of science. Maybe this biodiversity of scientific tradition is lost. I don't know if that's true, just a passing thought. So at CERN, then afterwards, I've been working with global science in a number of ways. As Director General of CERN, where I brought in the United States, India, China, Japan, Russia, I've forgotten some of them, Canada. I've been the president of the ITER Council, the World Fusion Project, that has some challenges, I'll mention them later. And also, and you didn't say this actually, I followed Howard Chopper as the first president of the CERN Council, the Sesame Council, and I'm currently the president of the Sesame Council. So I think in my career I've seen and appreciated diplomacy in action to support science, to negotiate the agreements, and science in action to support diplomacy. These are two opposite aspects of the same thing.
Thanks, Chris. Let me just have one personal comment. Thank you very much for mentioning Pagłoś, because my father was the president of Pagłoś Council for 21 years, and together with John Holdren, he was getting the Peace Nobel Prize in 95, which I witnessed in Oslo. This actually made me very dedicated to science for peace as well. Zera, it's now your turn.
Well, I was interested in science all my life, so as long as I knew I had a conscience. So that's how I was into science. But international science was also very important for me from the very beginning, because I grew up in a family who had very strong international relations, and I went to UK for my PhD. There I had the chance to work with people from different countries. Then I moved on to Sweden when I wanted to learn some new techniques. And then I came to EMBL. This is the European Molecular Biology Laboratory, which to their laboratory that was based on DESI in Hamburg to use synchrotron radiation. In fact, I was there when Herwig Schopper was, I think, the director of DESI. So and EMBL is a very good example of an international organization which is put together out of the need of the scientists, and then which also creates a very good environment for people to work with. Well, I didn't think of working at Sesame at the beginning, but I will talk about that later, maybe afterwards, when I mentioned more about Sesame.
Thanks, Zera. Now, Von Turekian, please.
Raji, thank you so much. You tell the story of your father and how that was inspirational for you in science for peace. I think I can say the same thing from maybe even a younger age. I remember when I was a young child, my father was a geochemist, and he went out to Caltech to meet with one of his very close friends and collaborators, somebody named Pat Patterson. For those that know geochemistry and sort of Earth chronology, Pat was the person that refined the age of the Earth using geochemical techniques. And I remember sitting there in that room with my father. I just loved airplanes, so I would travel with my father in the summer when I could. And the two of them, Pat and my father, Carl, were sitting there screaming at each other, yelling at each other, anything but peace, one would think. And so I came out as a young child, a little bit scarred by the fact that my father was yelling at somebody. You think they only yell at the children, but they actually were yelling at people that they were meeting with. And I turned to my father and I said, "Dad, why are you friends with this man? Or why did you meet with this man? You two seem to hate each other." And he said, "No, Pat's one of my closest friends. We've known each other for 35 years. We were arguing about whether lead isotopes were the better thing to use over cesium isotopes." And I thought at that moment that, in fact, science is the one place where you can actually have intense and detailed arguments with somebody or other places, and yet you're arguing about substance. And that's the thing that can bring us together, is that you can argue, but you know at the end of the day you're arguing to solve a problem.
Thanks. Now, the second question would be about actually two examples, CERN and Sesame. Herwig and Chris and Zera are insiders of Sesame. CERN, of course, is for Herwig and for Chris. Herwig, can you tell us how was it when you became the director of CERN and you had this big project in front of you? Was it difficult to handle? What were the complications? How you actually bypass it? Was the fact that it was science easier, make it more possible? What would you like to share with us from your vast experience? You were, I think, the longest director of CERN ever, because you were extended. Usually directors are not extended, but you were constructing this big machine. So you had particular experience with this. Can you share it? But for 8 minutes, please.
Yes. Therefore, I would like to answer your question directly because it's more dealing with management and things like that. And we should concentrate here on science or peace, I think. So excuse me if I come back later to your question. As you said, I think the specificity of CERN and also Sesame is that they were both based on two initiatives, one from the scientists and the other one from politicians who used the science to bring together nations. The result of that is, that's partly also relevant for your question, is that in the government bodies of both CERN and Sesame, each member state is represented by two delegates. One is a government representative, you're a ministerial official, and the other one is scientists. But that is, a very special combination of scientists and possibilities, and provides an almost unique possibility to bring together scientists, policymakers, and so on, to create synergies between the different countries and nations. Now, let me give you two examples how CERN really contributed for science or peace. And from these examples, I think what can discuss, what can be learned from it, and what lessons would follow. During the hottest time of the Cold War in the 1960s, CERN was the only, I think it was the only Western organization which was prepared to sign an agreement at that time with the Soviet Union between CERN and the Institute of High Energy Physics in the Soviet Union, where it doesn't matter. Later, I learned that this contract, this agreement, was a basis, some confidence was built up by that agreement, and so I learned later that this became a basis for a similar agreement between the Soviet Union and United States. And finally, again, one step further, this became a model for an agreement before signed by President Brezhnev and who was it? Brezhnev and Ford, sorry. Which was signed by Brezhnev and Ford. And so one can see that from science in various steps one can build up trust, which I think is essential, because the best agreements in politics are nothing worse if they are not based on some trust. And another example, which happened during my time in Geneva, was there was a negotiations between President Reagan and Gorbachev at that time. In fact, it's exactly these days, 30 years ago. And these presidential meetings, of course, are prepared by experts, and since it was disarmament negotiations, were prepared by physicists who came in. So one day I got a call by a physicist, American physicist who I knew, who was the leader of the American delegation, and he told me, look, in these official meetings we cannot get anywhere. We are in an impasse. The only thing which would help would be that we could meet us in a neutral environment, in an environment where we are both respected, where we can trust it, and where we can speak. So I said, fine, I'll invite you to dinner. So they came, really had dinner at CERN, and next day I was informed that really that was a breakthrough. Now, to come to your question. When I was at CERN, this big project, the first project lab, was approved, which is a tunnel, which my successor as Director General continued, was that the member state said, look, this big new project can only be approved if you do it in a constant budget. That was one of the major issues. And in order to do that, whether I liked it or not, we had to say, okay, CERN will provide the infrastructure, the tunnel and the machine, but all the experiments have to be financed by the outside. There practically no contribution to CERN. This condition, whether I like it or not, still exists after 30 years. CERN practically still has a constant budget with some compensation for inflation, and all the projects, new projects, are financed by the outside users themselves. The effect of that was that the outside users had to get together, and in a way, with the help of CERN, of course, and with the mentality of CERN, set up their own projects financed by hundreds of institutions coming from many countries and thousands of scientists, and built up, in a way, their own project, which are called experiments, but these are not really experiments, these are really international organizations by themselves. And to our big surprise, these things work. These are projects costing billions of dollars or euros, whatever you want, involving all these people I mentioned, and do not have a strong hierarchy. I would say a restricting hierarchy. They are organized democratically. Objectives are defined from bottom up. The essential point is that I think is a political issue one can learn. All partners, no matter whether big or small, are treated equal. There's no leading country, no leading institution. I think that is a secret of success. Whoever comes up with a proposal, he's listened to. Only the quality of the proposal counts, not where he comes from. And well, there are many other things one could add to that, but I think continue that. It's really a miracle how that works. And well, these so-called experiments have no CEO, no legally responsible chief executive officer. And if I talk to industrialists, they say it's impossible, such a project, global project, with many partners, cannot work, but it does. They worked, and they could be, these experiments could be performed, or executed, project could be executed in the time foreseen and within the budget foreseen. I think that's remarkable. Well, coming now to Sesame. When I was in asked in 1999, after my time as Director General of CERN, the idea came up at CERN, by theoreticians, in fact, to create a synchrotron radiation laboratory in the Middle East. And I was approached and said, well, you are free now as Director General of CERN. Couldn't you take over and see what one could do? Well, my opinion was, and I think that was certainly right, such a project would only have a chance under the umbrella of UNESCO, much more so than CERN, as mentioned already by knowledge, because CERN was in a relatively stable situation, Europe was in a relatively stable situation, where the Middle East is still not. So I wrote at that time to the Director General of CERN, which was Frédéric Mayor, to ask him, Mayor, and ask him whether UNESCO would be prepared to take that project under its umbrella. He was enthusiastic immediately, invited all the governments in the Mediterranean region at a meeting at Paris, and out came, after a relatively short discussion, the foundation of Sesame. I mean, probably nobody knows what CESAME stands for. It's a complicated acronym. Forget it. We chose that name because I wanted to have a name which has a meaning both in the Arab world and the Western world. And CESAME, I think, is everywhere considered as a door opener. And I think that's what it's doing. Now, another matter, of course, was to find a host state for the project. So I was traveling around at that time with Assistant Director General Iaccarino of UNESCO. We visited various countries, and you can imagine the discussions were very difficult, but finally we came to Jordan. Fortunately there, the ground had been prepared already by Professor Badran. I'm very happy to see him here, who just had come back as Deputy Director General of UNESCO and had prepared the ground, but still it was very difficult, and the breakthrough came finally when we could get an audience with His Majesty the King, and we told him, well, for the project to carried out in the spirit of CERN, in the spirit of Sesame, being open, one condition must be fulfilled. Every scientist of the world who wants to work there must get access. You can imagine that in that region was not easy to achieve. And I was surprised that His Majesty the King immediately said yes. When I said, can I have that in writing? Half an hour later, I had a letter by him guaranteeing that. And I must say, after now more than almost 15 years, this promise was kept. We never had problems for people to come to Jordan. When there are problems, they are not because of Jordan, because of other reasons. So Sesame started there. You heard the member states which were there. Of course, the original idea was to bring together Israel and Palestine. But now there's also Iran there and the other member states you heard, but strangely enough also Cyprus and Turkey, which are not particularly friendly countries nowadays. But it works. And look, one experience which I think is very important for the future is if you have a body like the council, which like at CERN you have delegates which are government representatives, and delegates which are scientists, they come much easier to compromises than the politicians alone. Scientists, in a way, are more open to find compromises, to find solutions, than government officials who sometimes are bound by instructions they have. So I think that is one of the big positive results. Finally, I think I have said everything I wanted to say. Well, let me just point out again, as it was mentioned already, Sesame needs much more help from UNESCO than CERN. One reason was mentioned is the political situation, but more than that, the constitution of Sesame is practically a copy of the constitution of CERN. My successor, as was mentioned, of Sesame reminded me this morning, there's one essential difference. One essential difference is that in the council, UNESCO has a seat and a vote. Then the secretary of the council is appointed by UNESCO with a vote. And this place, this position was taken by our chairman here for many years.
And UNESCO has a vote in the council.
In the council. And thanks to the chairman, but also to the previous director general of UNESCO, Matsura, I will not go into details now, who also saved saved Sesame in some critical position, Sesame still exists. So thanks very much to UNESCO, in particular also to our chairman. Thank you.
Thanks, Hervik. Chris, you continue on the on the science for peace in CERN and Sesame.
So I'm actually going to come to the science for peace and diplomacy for science, but let me start with diplomacy to enable science rather than science to enable diplomacy, although it's not the major topic. So my experience of putting at CERN and then trying to get this quite different set of countries in the global fusion project, ITER, off the ground, I just very briefly mention a few lessons, and then I'll come back to science for peace. The first is that in setting up big collaborations is not straightforward and always takes a lot more time than anybody expects, because you have to develop confidence among the governments, the scientists are relatively easy, but the different governments, officials, and this is one of many things that went wrong with ITER, that there was not enough time allowed for that. The second is that it's really important to bring all parties in early so they're on an equal footing, and if possible, before the design of whatever project you're doing is frozen, so that they can have a say in it. And in fact, it's important not to freeze the design too early, because there will be political delays, and if you've frozen the design, it may be redundant by the time you get there. That's very difficult, because it means you've got to get political approval before you've frozen the design. You don't know the cost, so that's sort of difficult. The third thing is that I'm sorry to say, Vaughan, but you can answer this on this. By far the hardest collaborator I've ever had to deal with is the United States. And the reason for that, possibly we're divided by a common language, as Churchill said, although it was first said about the Austrians and Germans, I think. The reason is first a constitutional one, that the US cannot make long-term commitments. Any agreement is subject to annual availability of funding, and the other partners find that very difficult to understand or to accept, but it's just a constitutional fact about the United States. The second is that the US for a long time was the unique superpower in the world. So I have to say it's sometimes quite difficult for the US to think of being a collaborator on the same footing as others. And this was particularly because you said this about the large experiments. When I was getting the US into the LHC, they say, who's responsible if it doesn't work? We shoot you, do you? And I say, no, this is dispersed throughout the world. So it's shared, and the responsibility is shared. That's quite difficult to understand. And the notion of collaboration is not so easy if you're used to being the leading partner. Now, the way I would put that, I was asked afterwards, what did you learn from your experience collaborating with the United States? And my answer would be, I understand much better what people thought of my country, United Kingdom, in the 19th century, where I'm sure it was exactly the same situation. A single superpower has quite, it's difficult to collaborate on any, it can be done, and it is done.
It's empirically correct.
Well, I said you have a chance to come back on this, and to adapt the different ways of doing things. Now let me come to science for diplomacy, science for peace. So the first thing to say is, how does that work? How does it relate to peace? And I think it is that the scientists and technicians and engineers who work together arrive often with very different political, religious, cultural views, but they develop technical respect. And from the technical respect, they start to say, oh, maybe I should take his views at least more tolerant. I'll listen to what they say about other things. So I give you an explicit example. A colleague of ours, Hafiz Harani, who's from Pakistan, wanted to take a group of technicians to CERN. And they came back to him and said, but there are Israelis in this group. These people are devils. We can't go. And he said, I'm telling you, you're coming. And 3 months later, they came back and said, they're quite good technicians. And actually, they're quite nice guys anyway. So it starts that people, if you work together technically, you become more tolerant and you develop respect for people. Actually, the other answer, in the same way, in a way, is how did CERN work? I remember when I first went there in the 60s, people would say, how the hell do you get a project where the French and the British work together? And there was a flippant answer, which was there was a compromise. And the compromise was the French learned to speak English and the English learned to shake hands. But I think the real answer was that it had to work. People's careers depended on it working. So they made it work. If you wanted to be in particle physics in Europe, the only way to compete with the United States was for CERN to work. So this is my next point, that if you want to do, you can't sit down and say, let's do science for peace. Science has to come first. If SESAME is a good scientific instrument, the hotshot physicists from around the region, or biochemists, or chemists, whatever, will go there. And they will develop friendships. If it isn't a first-rate instrument, they won't go. So my job is very, very simple. It's to make sure it's a good scientific instrument. That is not to say that there are not rocks along the way, and I'll just mention two, so don't think it's all sweetness and light. Travel restrictions, Herwig pointed to it. In principle, we'd like to have a council meeting, one in Amman, one in one of the members every year. But most of the members are not giving visas to some of the others at any point. So it's extremely difficult, and we've not really succeeded in doing it. At times of political tension, it can be very difficult, and I'll give you an example. We had a council meeting in Cairo, so that was a rather rare example of meeting in the Middle East, not in Jordan. We've also met in Turkey and in Cyprus. And that morning, before we went into the meeting, people switched on the TV, and the Turks had sent a boat to Gaza, and the Israelis had landed on it. Some of you will remember this. So tensions were quite high in the room, because we just heard this in the last hour. And actually, it was a Turk, and they had sent the boat, Dinsa Ooktu, who was the vice president of the council, who defused the situation. But it's not easy meeting during conflict. And if there's immediate conflict going on during a meeting, it is not simple. I'm often asked, what was the effect of the Arab Spring and the political turmoil generally in the Middle East? And the answer is, of course, political turmoil means financial difficulty, which we're seeing worldwide. And it's been very difficult for many members to pay. And one of the reasons is that if you've been in science funding, it's not the magnitude of the budget that matters, it's the gradient. And if you're building a project, the budget's going up 20% every year. That's very difficult for finance ministries, although the sums by Western standards are pretty small. But most of the members are paying anyway. If I'm asked what are the direct effects of the Arab Spring or the political turmoil, there have been two. Iran is one of four members, the others are Turkey, Israel and Jordan, that agreed to put voluntarily an additional $5 million into this project. This money is frozen in Iran. And they can't pay their annual subscription. If that money gets out, we can finish next year. If it doesn't, it's going to be quite difficult. So that's a real problem. And the other direct example I can give you is, I mentioned four countries giving $5 million, and at the beginning, Egypt said, we'd like to be involved. And the day before we had the meeting to discuss this, the Egyptians changed the government. And I've negotiated with every government, and then it changes every 6 months. It changed most recently in September, the government in Egypt. If there's anybody from Egypt here, we've had statements, we're going to join this and pay. But we really need that. So there are bumps along the road, but the fact is, I think, in the case of Sesame, we're on track. I think we will get something operating next year, and I very much hope it will be a great success.
Thanks, Chris. I think we are having an interesting discussion, and I'm looking forward to Von Turekian when he will come to replying to some of your comments.
Oh, it's science and peace.
Exactly.
But we just learned, you said, we can fight.
Before you reply, we'll first Zera, because I would like her to talk still about Sesame and a point of view of a member state representative, because Turkey is a member of Sesame, and Zera is actually planning to work with Sesame. So, Zera, what is your vision of science for peace through Sesame?
Yes. Well, first of all, I come from the example of EMBL, as I said, the European Molecular Biology Laboratory, which is an international organization, and that was the place where I had most of my training, most of my sort of ripe working professional life before I went back to Turkey. Now, there I learned something. Two very important things. One of them is the quality of science. That comes first. You are passionate about your science, you are passionate about your projects, and you want it to work. So this becomes a real passion which stops you from sleeping, stops you from eating. You just go for it. You just work for it. And it doesn't matter who it is you're working with, because you are all working for one goal. And for me, that is one of the most important things at Sesame. We're all working for having an excellent laboratory in the Middle East, which produces good science, which trains people, and it's a very good legacy for the younger generations. That I find very important. And the other point is that curiosity. The scientists are curious. They talk to each other. They want to know what the other one is doing. They want to know if there is something they can take over and if there is something they can give to the next person. So this makes scientists talk to each other, work together, and that is a very strong motivation as far as I'm concerned for Sesame. Now, I'm currently going to Germany, to the EMBL laboratory, to DESI campus, with my students to use the equipment there, and the minute Sesame becomes available, we will go there, because We have been in Sesame from the beginning. We've been making plans. So we're going to go there and use the facilities to the end. And this will give us a very good opportunity because we may have more time there. We usually get very short periods of measurement in Germany, whereas at Sesame we will have, I think, better chance to do experiments in a more relaxed, in a more comfortable environment where we can do things. Now, one of the things that I think is important, it's also Sesame is taking place in a part of the world where long-term projects are not common. I can speak for Turkey. I think there was only one long-term project, and that was building a series of dams in southeast Turkey, which was a project that went over 20 years or so. But we're not used to, other than that, we're not used to long-term scientific projects. We're not used to making long-term planning. So this is one of the good things that Sesame is contributing to this area. At least I think in Turkey, we learned a lot about long-term planning through our contributions and interaction with Sesame. So this is important, an important investment for future. And finally, I would like to say a few words about working on questions relevant to the region. Sesame will bring in a technology which is up to date, and which will give us the possibility to address specific questions either in the field of medicine, molecular biology, materials, environmental questions, and also questions about heritage, analysis of materials from our cultural heritage. So we will have this opportunity in the region to use a state-of-the-art equipment for questions that are interesting for ourselves. And this will also give us a niche, because we will be competing with big institutions all over the world. Certain things are easier to arrange, easier to access when all the countries involved are more or less at the same line and at the same level. Now, we're not. We have discrepancies among the countries, and also we have, as a community, some disadvantages compared to the rest of the world. So I think it is important that we do focus on these questions, which will create, I think, a good niche for us for our work at Sesame. And finally, I'm involved in Sesame because I think I know it is the only thing I would like to leave to my grandchildren. The others will come and go, but I think this will stay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Zara. Now, Vaughn, we are looking forward to your comments to what you heard, but also opinions about science for peace and the general scope of this session.
Sure. No, I will gladly not throw out my remarks because I think that they are a positive example of the fact that the U.S. has been very engaged in the role of science for peace. I think that, you know, I'm pleased that, you know, so many of my colleagues here are colleagues I've had a chance to meet both during the time that I was not in government and now that I am in government. And also, you know, to be honest and frank, I think one of the things that's been a great example of the U.S. in working with the world has been that our universities in the science and technology area have been really one of the great ways to interact not only as partners with the world, but also attracting some of the best talent, including my colleague Chris Llewellyn-Smith, who spent some time at Stanford. And we think that these types of things, these types of interactions, where people meet each other and interact with each other and share ideas, are some of the best ways in which science gets done, I think, by top scientists like Chris and my colleagues here, and many of you today, but also the way in which science can help build bridges and build peace. I will remark very quickly, as I mentioned, this is my second time in government, and the first time in government I had the privilege to be involved in a little bit parts of the ITER process, and I would say that if we go back and we look at ITER, I would say that it would be very difficult to say that the U.S. was the reason why ITER's had some difficulties. No, and I think that we were a very happy and proud partner at that time and continue to be. And I think that it's a wonderful thing to look. I remember, I mentioned my father so once before. I remember when my daughter was born. So my last name's Tarikian. It's not a very common name. when my daughter was born in 2009 and my father was born in 1927. And my father called up and he said, you know, Alina and I, my daughter's name is Alina, Alina and I share three things in common. First, our last name is Tarikian. Second, and again, this is 2009. Second, we were born in a year when the economy was not doing so well. And third, we were born in a year when fusion is 50 years away. So, anyway, on that note, I really do appreciate the opportunity to speak here. I really enjoyed the history of UNESCO. It's something that I know that we are in the United States proud to have been involved with from the start, from the conception of UNESCO. It's done amazing things. We, in the U.S., obviously, it's not always the easiest relationship, but we are so pleased that we are going to remain on and then be part of the governing board. I have actually, in my previous life as a scientist, and during my time at IIIS, have benefited greatly from interacting with UNESCO and being part of UNESCO. And it's just, I think some of the stories here that we're hearing are just great examples of how UNESCO really, and particularly something that inserts the S part of into the UN system, is such a valuable thing. When we think of science diplomacy, or when I've thought about it in the past, I've always thought about the sort of two areas. One is the issue of actions, because ultimately actions, and we've heard here from our colleagues about actions, and the other one is tools. And so when I think of actions, one of the great sort of examples and moments that I had was actually 2 years ago at this event in Brazil. I was actually not in the government at that time, but I had a colleague who was then the deputy and is still my deputy at State Department. And the World Science Forum brings together scientists from around the world, sticks to its name. And one of the scientists there who came to Brazil was Fidel Castro's son, Fidelito, and some of you may know him. And my colleague from now at the State Department, my deputy, but at the time I was obviously working someplace else, was able to interact with Fidelito. And at that time, the U.S. and Cuba had a obviously very complicated relationship. Well, she was able to use that discussion to begin to lay the groundwork for a scientist going down to Cuba. And a couple of years later, or actually a year later, when I was at IIIS, we went down, and at IIIS we had a number of engagements around science cooperation with Cuba, and my deputy joined that, one of those trips. It's the first time coming from the foreign ministry, or the U.S. foreign ministry, in 50 years, somebody who was not there to just talk about the difficult issues, but somebody there to talk about some of the good issues. And she went down, and she joined our delegation as a government representative, and met with not the foreign ministry, but with a bunch of people from the science ministry, from the environment ministry, and yeah, students. And what we came away with, or what she came away with, and what I think many of us knew is, look, science and health collaboration are wonderful ways to interact no matter what the politics are. Because the issues of disease at the time, and still, things like chikungunya, there's a disease that requires cooperation, it requires people to work together. And these are issues, I'm an atmospheric chemist by training. You can't look at something like the transport of African dust and not see the interconnectedness and the need for people to work together. It is dust that forms and blows in the beautiful Sahara region and mixes with many things, and it comes over the Atlantic Ocean, and it comes and it deposits throughout the Amazon Basin and up into the Caribbean, and actually into Houston, Texas, where there are soils that you can look back on. And it provides such a great example of the connection through the air, through the sea, but critically through the people that study it. The second part that we think about is the issue of tools for science diplomacy. And actually here I want to talk about something called science and technology diplomacy. Because really it is the technologies that help us build peaceful, in many ways, apply peaceful things and solve problems. The Haiti earthquake in 2010 was a horrible event, and one that really impacted a lot of people. And what was interesting is, I have colleagues who are at something called the U.S. Institute for Peace. A great title, right? They're there to look at ways to provide peace. And they look not just at technology, but at other things as well. And they were looking at the fact that the early responders, the first responders, were coming up with information, but there was no way to aggregate the data. And so that people in the field, and people that were sitting there and texting their issues, there was no way to bring that data together. And so they developed, through this organization called Peace Tech at the University, at the U.S. Institute for Peace, a program to begin to aggregate the data and aggregate the tweets and aggregate the Facebook postings to see and hear what people were going through so they could more easily and better target the response and the first response. In many ways, the application of technology, the application of science, the use of science and technology together, but most importantly, the people involved, are the ways that we begin to build a better world. I'm reminded, actually, when my son had an open-heart surgery when he was 6 days old, and I sort of thought about a lot of things, and there was sort of the globalization of science and medicine that I was a great beneficiary of. And so one of those late nights in the hospital, I started, you know, sort of looking in some ways for inspiration for quotes about children. And I came across one of my favorite quotes that I read about from President Kennedy. And it's not just about children, but it does, I think, sum up what we think about when we think about science for peace. And he said, speaking to college graduates at American University, that our most basic common link is we all inhabit this planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future. And we are all mortal. And as we sit here and we think about the role of science diplomacy and science for diplomacy, science and diplomacy, we also have to start thinking about the problems that science can solve in the future. Something that I would call anticipatory science diplomacy. Anticipating where the great challenges are going to be coming and how the scientific community, how we can start looking at that, training the next generation, and thinking about how to knit that together in a way to build not just a more peaceful, but a more prosperous and happy society, and the role of science and scientists in doing that. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. I think with historical background and quite vivid comments later on, we have a good kind of history of what Science for Peace is. Now, we have about 10 minutes for questions, because I would like to have interaction with... The first question was here, the second was there. Okay, sir, please.
Thank you very much. We've heard the Director Generals of CERN and the other administrators of major science projects. I had the honor of working at CERN between 1999 and 2001. And I'm also very happy that we helped design the only Pakistani-designed and manufactured thing at CERN, which is the tracker, the detector pollution monitoring system. So 40 systems were designed and built in my lab. I'll keep it closer. And it's all there. I'll like to make it a little in a lighter note. You mentioned the issue of financing for SESAMI. Now, we did not put any money into CERN from Pakistan, but we made contributions in kind. So many of the things we were able to do locally was valued and was regarded as a contribution of the country. And this was a great help. But one of the things, for example, was the 28 tons each, the feet for the tracker at the CMS. And the joke, on a lighter vein, we were supposed to send them to Geneva from Pakistan. We sent them instead to Genoa in Italy. This is not the fault of the organization, the Atomic Energy Commission, but that of the other people. I'd like to say one other thing, please. We, science and peace, a very difficult subject, zigzagging over the years. And you mentioned Kennedy. And during Kennedy's time, a book was commissioned, whom the author is not known, but is suspected to be Kenneth Galbraith. Yep. The Report from Iron Mountain. Kennedy commissioned a group of senior people and intellectuals to look at what might happen when the Cold War ends. And the conclusion of this little book was, peace is not possible. Even if it was possible, it's not desirable. But things have changed in the last 50 years, and let's hope it stays this way. Thank you very much.
Okay. Yes, Chris, please.
Yeah, just very briefly, this agreement that Pakistan contributed to CERN, I actually signed the agreement with your Prime Minister. But I just wanted to say very briefly something, which is I would not have been so provocative about the United States if I had not known that my good friend Norman had a chance to come back. And I really should have said that the difficulties I pointed to are superficial.
with the American involvement in CERN, it is subject to annual availability of funding, but they pay. Mm-hmm. It worked. And these differences of attitude and thinking, you know, we're the boss here, we got round those things. So all those things have in fact worked. And I also think you were quite right to draw my attention that in the 50s and 60s, when science in Europe had not recovered, US was the essential nation. Practically all young scientists, as I did, spent time in the US, and we're all very grateful for that. Now we have science at the, we hope, at the same standing, and it's our job to open our doors to the rest of the world, the developed world, to come and work in Europe if they want to.
Yeah, I just want to add that Chris is a genius as somebody who's a sort of keeps people in the seats, right? I thought that was really well done. Here it is, it's 6 o'clock at the end of the day, and we're waiting to go to a reception, and you were able to do something that I hope kept the people in the seats so we could have a good conversation, which is always good, I think. So thank you.
Uri Shamir from Israel. CERN has to be credited by allowing Israelis to come into the work there way early in the game, and I think that Sesame benefits from that, from the acquaintance that they've had. But I would like, with your permission, Chair, to raise something completely different. IASA, the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Luxembourg, was established in 1972 on the initiative of McGeorge Bundy, who was at the time Secretary of Defense. This was an East-West attempt with 11 countries to address matters that are not in the same domain as, say, CERN or Sesame, where I visited, by the way. I visited Sesame as well. This had to do with matters that are win-win situations on health, transportation, air pollution, water, where I was involved. It now has, instead of the first 11 countries, it has now 23. And the idea was to bring their scientists of the top level, who could then speak to the ears of their governments, basically. And that has worked. And until the wall fell in 1990, it was oriented east-west. Mm-hmm. And the top scientists were there all along, dealing with matters that were of common interest. And it's been working very well. In 1990, when the wall fell, it reoriented itself north-south. Next week, there is a conference at IASA on systems analysis, which is divided basically into two aspects. One is the methodologies that applied in systems analysis, and the other is on the applications. Here is another very successful experience that has developed over the times, and it's very stable. It doesn't seem to have too many financial problems at this point in time. It's located in a beautiful Schloss, just 1 hour south of Vienna, in Baden, called Schloss Luxembourg. I'm going to go there next week. I've been there many times before, and I think that's a wonderful way of doing things. The first director, Howard Rafer, from the Kennedy School of Government, was there for a long time. And it took a lot of negotiations to get this thing on the ground. He's written a book about that, basically. But it's still working very successful, and that's another kind of experience that we should look to. Thank you.
Thank you for this. Panel wants to comment on this?
I'm only going to say that I've spent a lot of time in the last 2 years persuading my government to rejoin, and I'm very pleased to say they just did.
Okay, there is another question. You have Mike.
Okay, hello everyone. I'm Shaker Zbada from Palestine. That's why this subject is very interested for me. I think before we discussed about the science and the development and something like this, in my opinions, there is a questions debates, which is effective, which, for example, in my opinions, science leads to peace or peace leads to science. I know this is a debate questions, mm-hmm. but for example, in the conflict area like Palestine, and we need minimum peace, like which means peace, life. This is, I mean, the peace. Without life, without peace, we can't reach the science to develop our countries. This is, I think this is very important questions. That's why it's difficult, the relation between science and peace. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Your last question.
Thank you so much. My name is Arimoto from Japan. I can show you some different our experiences, US-Japan. Science, diplomacy, science for peace, science for diplomacy. You may remember even the after 10 years after the World War II end, Japan, US-Japan, the relationship devastated. But early the Kennedy administration, early 1960s, US-Japan, the science and technology agreement signed up. After those regime, the US-Japan, the science relationship expanded, oceanography, and the diseases, and the US universities, the accepting a lot of the Japanese young students. Now those students growing up, the world-renowned scientists and engineers are supported by mainly the National Science Foundation. So the born the predecessor, the first chief science of the Norman Lewlighter, made every effort early 1960s, 70s, those expanding the relationship. Anyway, science diplomacy made a lot of the contribution to the reform the US-Japan, the economic relationship as well as the political relationship. So those kind of the experiences should transfer to the young generations. This is important point. Of course, your side is the Palestinian as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Your question now. I have taken the use of my mic and I will
help you. I'm Christian Kober. I work for the European Commission. And the institution I work for was initially founded on a different principle, not science for peace, but economic cooperation for peace. But nevertheless, in the last 30 years, it has grown into a major player in the field of cooperation, international cooperation in education, science, culture. And so I found it very interesting, these presentations, especially to listen to the origin of UNESCO, to see how the philosophy and the vision of mankind was a very important founding principle. Now I wonder, given that the European Commission is an active player, how is the relationship with UNESCO? Is there room for collaboration? Is it working well, or can there be more done in this area?
We have official agreement signed between the European Commission and UNESCO, and we collaborate in many areas. Actually, science diplomacy is a good example, because we are together with the European Commission constructing now a new big program in science diplomacy, which stems actually from a meeting in Amman, which was organized in January of this year, with participation of Commissioner Medas and Mrs. Flavia Schlegel, our ADG Science, around the issue of sesame. So this somehow triggered the idea of this new big program that we hope to finalize. So fortunately, there are good relations. Last point from Professor Murenzi to us.
So when we talk about peace, between nations, and I think the presentation was very clear that science is very important and we can bring up scientists together, which is good with scientists because they have critical thinking. Critical thinking is very, very important. I thought that when I arrived in Rwanda in 2001 to be the Minister of Education, 6 years after, 7 years after the genocide, where 1 million people died, they will tell people, go and kill so-and-so, and the person will go and kill. So that critical thinking was really missing. And you realize throughout the educational system, that is a very important issue. So I thought that science education was very central in primary school throughout the educational system, but starting from at very elementary school. So in the curriculum, even in the science policy, the educational policy, to see that how can these children, when they are in primary school, can learn about critical thinking, math and science about the environment, but also knowing that the person near you is also has blood. He can suffer, he has the feeling like you. So that is very, very central. So as UNESCO has pushed for this education for all, for the 15 years from 2000 to 2015, I thought that pushing education for all, putting more children in primary school, but also teaching them about basic science, critical thinking, was very, very central. Because you guys are sitting there because you have a chance to have that in primary school in your educational system. So when you talk between you, you know that there is a point you need to go through, and then you have the critical thinking and you have a evidence base, and then you reach an outcome. There are countries where, or places where, that is not possible. So I thought that's something that we should be able to think at some point as we do this kind of debate.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you, Roman. Now, let me ask the panel, would you like still to add something or give a reaction to what you heard? Yes, Herbie, please.
Very short remark. I think the discussion between science and politics and vice versa is not easy. But I'm very grateful, and I think it's very gratifying at least that it started and is taking place, or not started, but it's getting intensified. I'm very happy that we had discussion here, but I would like to inform you also that on Monday this week, we had in Geneva a whole day's meeting at the UN in Geneva, where all the other sub-organizations of UN, in addition to UNESCO, were there, where was discussed how could one apply experiences from CERN and CESAME both to other institutions. Of course, very diversified, it was going from WHO to meteorology. I cannot discuss it here, it's very complicated, but I was surprised how much ideas came up, how one could profit from such a dialogue. So I think that's very gratifying. Thank you.
Chris, please.
Yeah, I'd like to make 2 points. The first is about the role of these projects in getting young people interested in science, which is vital for the future of all of us, as you said. And I'm very pleased to report to you that CERN this year ran a Sesame Summer School, where they invited all the members of Sesame to send a teacher and a school kid, and they did. So there was a meeting at CERN from every Sesame member, really every member, more than one in some cases, at least two people, one teacher and one kid, and I think that's really, really good. Now, related to that, I want to say that this is about building long-term prosperity. If you talk about science for peace, people think, oh, it's sort of science, fun for the scientists, but it's about, and you said it, about technology. It's more than that, and part of the role of Sesame is to underwrite the long-term, I hope, prosperity of the region. Which is really important, and to keep or to prevent or reverse the brain drain. Sesame at the beginning, Herwig did it, put a lot of people to be trained to build accelerators, and they've gone back and they are building Sesame. Some of them have left, and that's actually a tribute to the good training they got. Some left the region, that's not so good, but some took other jobs in the region. That's a success. These people are now working in industry in the member states, having been trained by Sesame. And the point I wanted to make is this: it seems to be very hard to convince people who control aid budgets that putting money behind science could be part of aid. So my country boasts that it puts, I think it's 0.8% of GDP into overseas aid. It's one of the highest in the world. And as a British citizen, I'm proud of that and actually slightly surprised that this particular government did it. But they have done it. But if I say, oh, what about something to Sesame? They say, well, that's not aid, that's science. And they say, when it comes to it with the aid budget, there's a lot of rhetoric about supporting long-term goals. But in the end, the people who control aid budgets want to put it into things with immediate returns. Better sewage, better hospitals, better roads, clean water. That's very important. But some of they've got to get over the message that it's also important if they really want to underwrite long-term development, put money into science.
Thank you, Zara.
I would like to come back to you. Your question, the comment you made is very difficult. Do we do science when we have so many problems, other things to solve? Science is one of the ways where we can address these questions. Science is one of the ways where we can talk. I think that is the reason why it's important. And in fact, in worse times, we should find science as a means for communication. I think we need it. We need it even at the worst of times.
Thank you,
Bo. I think I'll just finish with a little bit with in three. Running around and discovering things, building things with Legos, going and smashing around and having fun discovering. And that's the piece that I think ultimately is the thing that leads to peace and prosperity throughout the world, is that we have interconnected, better informed, critical thinking citizens. I don't always love it when my children are critical thinking, especially when they pull out the iPad and check the facts on things I'm saying. But I do think that having critical thinking children and giving them opportunities is really the best thing that any of us can pass on to the next generation.
Thanks. Professor Rettel, you started. Would you like to have the last word?
I would like to say that how much I was happy to when I was digging into the history of the UNESCO to find all these details and the activity of Julian Huxley, who was a very controversial person. He was elected only for 2 years as a director general of the UNESCO. But what he did in these 2 years, it was really exemplary. And then what he did afterwards as a member of the UNESCO. And this pamphlet is, I think, it was perfectly forgotten in 30 years. The situation is the same. 70 years was also good enough to bury his ideas. And I would like to in somehow, with the help of the UNESCO, to go after his ideas and see that what is good and how can we solve our present problems with the combination of science and everything which is human, as he described 70 years ago.
Well, with this, I would like to thank the panel, thank the audience, and wish you a very nice boat trip and a fantastic dinner.
Thank you. Thank you.